This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be here till 2 p.m. This afternoon, I'm talking with two California authors on subjects that are very close to California, maybe more than other places. One is very explicitly that. It's part of the California Natural History Guide series published by the University of California Press, Introduction to Fire in California by David Carl. I talked to him this morning, and we'll play a recording of that conversation in just a few minutes. And then in the second half of the program, I'm going to talk with Lisa Marganelli, whose book Oil on the Brain and Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank came out in hardback last year and in paperback a couple of months ago. We'll be talking about a lot of the contents of the book, but other things having to do with the whole petroleum question, oil, gasoline, the whole thing. And that'll be a little after 1:30. David Carl is a retired park ranger who has, I think he worked for the California Parks for 27 years, and he's written a number of books for University of California Press. They're in the Natural History series, as I mentioned. They're fairly small books. I'm just measuring this one. It's 4.5 inches by 7.25. It would fit in a fairly large pocket, and you can take it around with you, but it's also good reading for just sitting at a desk or in a chair. It is full of pictures and maps, diagrams, easily the most informative short book on fire I've seen ever. He previously wrote a introduction to air in California, and I talked with him in November of 2006. Also an introduction to water in California, and I asked him if they were going to do one on Earth, and he said yes, even though this California Natural History series already has a book on soils in California. His book is going to have a slightly different slant. I don't know much more than that, but I'll be eager to see it when it comes out. As I said, I talked with David Carl earlier this morning, and I started out by reading a little bit from the book, then asked him some questions and let him go, and he had quite a lot to say. I really liked your definition of fire at the very beginning of the book. It's probably similar to ones in other textbooks, but I've never seen something quite this concise and elegant. You say, combustion, another name for fire, is an energy-releasing chemical reaction that, once initiated, can become self-perpetuating. When enough heat is generated to make the fire contagious, nearby fuels are dried and their temperature increases. At the ignition temperature, chemical bonds between carbon and hydrogen break. It is vaporized molecules, rather than the solid fuel, that actually ignite in flaming combustion as the gaseous fuel cloud reacts with oxygen in the air. That oxidation, yet another name for burning, produces carbon dioxide and water. This really emphasizes what a part of the natural cycle of existence on Earth fire is. It's always been with us, it probably always will be, and it can be something that fits very nicely into our lives. But that isn't the way we seem to treat outdoor fires, what we call forest fires or wildfires these days.
You know, one of the the reasons for writing this book, and one of the overall goals that I hope people will take away if they pick up the book and read it is, and look at all the illustrations too, if they're heavily illustrated, is that fire is really an inevitable force on this planet, and certain parts of the world experience wildfire or natural fire more than others, and that's true across the variations of landscape in California too. But it is there. It is something that is inevitable, and it will come eventually at some interval that is dictated by various aspects of where you live and what kind of vegetation there is and what kind of weather and climate is and what that's all doing. All that fits together into something that is part of what the world has. It does have to do with oxygen, the fact that we have an atmosphere that is heavy with oxygen. And oxidation is part of the chemical process of what goes on when things burn. It's the oxygen is necessary for the fire, and oxygen likes to react and so and break things down in simpler forms. And by taking complex molecules of plants of the vegetation and turning them into these simple things like carbon dioxide and water, the products of oxidation, a whole lot of heat and energy is released, and it can be heat, it can also be the visual light that we see of fire, the flames, and that's the essence of what we're talking about, the chemical reaction of fire.
Well, California has a wide range of landscapes, vegetations, and climates, but almost all of them seem particularly conducive to letting fire roar through.
Almost all of them. There are certain places where fire is a very rare visitor, and like the very high altitude at the tops of the mountains, where the fuel is just very far apart, and out in some of the desert landscapes. Although the deserts themselves have a fire regime, and in recent years there's been some pretty large fires out in our desert. Actually, there's a change that's been going on there. That's kind of interesting. The downwind from the Southern California source of air pollution, which includes nitrates that are blowing out across and into the desert, there's been a fertilizing effect going on in the Mojave and the lower Colorado deserts. And it's been actually increasing the growth of some of the annual plants, and the wildflowers sometimes are a nice product of that. But plants and grasses have increased the ability of fires to get started in and to move between what would have normally or more typically been spread apart, the bushes that we think about, the shrubs that are in the desert. So deserts have a very interesting kind of a fire regime, typically not every year kind of, or not as close together fire return interval, but there has been some pretty intense fires. There was the Joshua Tree National Monument fire just a couple of years ago, and there's some real striking photos in the book, I think, of an incredibly tall flame coming from Joshua trees and desert shrubs. They look very dwarfed, a little fire truck sitting in those flames. It's one of the striking images that's in the book.
The other landscapes or the other vegetation types, the grasslands and chaparral and forests, all seem to be set up to let fire go through periodically. It's not as rare as in the deserts or the high elevations. And much of the vegetation seems quite adapted to living with fire.
And for listeners in your part of the state there in the Sierra Nevada foothills and up into the higher mountains, there's an interesting mix of there from the lower foothills, the shrublands, the chaparral, that community, up into the pine forest and the mixed conifer forest. A real classic example of a fire regime that is very much adapted to frequent low-intensity fire is the ponderosa pine forest, where the forest where ponderosa pine dominates. And in that forest, the trees tended, before we started changing some of the fuel situation, the trees tended to be very big with a bark that is capable of withstanding low-intensity fires that were burning around them and never, more or at least not rarely, climbing up into the tops of the trees, I mean a crown fire. because the fires returned at a 5 to 10 year interval, often enough to keep things, keep the low ground fuels cleared out. And that kind of, that's one approach or one example of a adaptation to fire in a certain kind of plant community. But it does vary. And of course, I mentioned that, you know, down in the chaparral shrubland, we got something entirely different. There's a quote I used in the book when you're talking about the giant sequoias of the central and southern Sierra Nevada. John Muir talked about how fires come racing up through the shrublands with the very high plains that are typical of chaparral shrub, and then reach this area among the big trees, the giant sequoia and the ponderosa pine, and the flames would just lay down and start creeping along the ground instead of being these big flame lengths that get in the chaparral shrub. Clearly different things are happening in those two different kinds of vegetation. And if you're living, if you're a person who's got a community or a household or a farmer ranch or whatever in any of these different areas, what you experience in turn when the fires come is going to be different. It's a real challenge to live in a chaparral shrubland community when fire arrives, because they're very intense. We would call that a crown fire, a crowning through the shrubs, where it burns out the entire gallery of fuel that's there. We all know that the big stories about the really big fires that in California are the chaparral shrubland fires of Southern California when the Santa Ana winds blow. Again, just very challenging for people, because we would like to have the approach, I think, if I can make an analogy between the vegetation and ourselves, I think that we would all prefer to have the approach of a ponderosa pine, if you will, a well-adapted ponderosa pine, where our structures survive a fire, and then we go on from there, versus the other kinds of conifers that are, or the chaparral shrubs that are in a regime where everything naturally burns out, and the plants and trees are adapted to reseeding or resprouting to start over again. That approach doesn't work very well for people. That's what we tend to start using words like disasters if we get into that kind of an approach in the regime of people and fire.
Speaking of Nevada County, you have four maps of counties around the state: Alameda, San Diego, Los Angeles, and Nevada. And in the maps, you rate the fire hazard zones. The two that have the greatest amount of extreme or very high fire hazard are Nevada County and San Diego County. I imagine San Diego has always been that way because of a large amount of chaparral, but in Nevada County, it probably wasn't that way 150 years ago.
I think that's a pretty accurate thing to say. And what you're referring to are maps that we have some examples of that were prepared, coordinated by CAL FIRE, by the state agency, and completed basically last year, or as this book was coming into print, they were in the process of completing them. And what they are to map fire hazard risk zones or severity zones and for each of these counties. And then that information can be used by landowners when they sell or buy land. It's supposed to be part of a disclosure that what kind of risk zone you're in. And also, though, it's being tied to construction requirements. And if you're in a high fire zone now, there's some new law that's related to how construction happens. But yes, the difference between these different counties, and I chose those examples to try to show a range of different vegetation types and what's happening. While they both have this very deep red that shows the high risk, I think in Sierra Nevada, it's very true to, it's accurate to say that the part of the reason for the high risk is a matter of history of what we did. Most people, I think, who've paid attention to fire are aware that about a century ago, a concerted effort began, the national policy led by the U.S. Forest Service, to have, if possible, they basically tried to start putting every fire out as quickly as possible once they were detected. And In the fire regimes that I mentioned, that example, especially of ponderosa pine forest, where the more natural fire return interval was short return with low intensity ground fires, there was a change that occurred, and we're struggling now to deal with that with the buildup of fuels that then created ladder fuels, or called fuels that were able to send fire instead of just moving on the ground, send it up into the tops of trees and turn a forest fire into a crown fire, a fire that moves right across the canopy and basically burns, you know, takes these trees out. Trees that would be naturally adapted to the low intensity fire cannot survive that when you get into that kind of regime. There's been an effort, there's been a recognition of what happened, and since the 1970s, some policy change in regards to the beginnings of efforts to put some fire into certain of these ecosystems where the one phrase that's been used is that we have some fire-starved landscapes now where fire is missing. Try to return that, but return it in a controlled way, so rather than wait for the lightning ignition or whatever to get it going. There's been prescribed burning efforts at fuel thinning and reduction and followed by fire. And a whole range of controversial efforts, too, about this all gets into questions of thinning and logging and that kind of thing. There has been an effort, and certain agencies and certain places have been more successful at that than others. I think Yosemite National Park, ever since the 70s, has had a very mature and a very, a good, extensive fire ecology program and effort at doing this. And within that park, things are maybe, as an entity looking at it, things are in pretty good shape, I think, compared to some others. And it's difficult it's difficult in an area, again, like we're around Nevada City, Grass City, that part of the world, where you do have agencies. You have national forest land, but you've also got a lot of people mixed in. And that wildland-urban interface is just a dilemma. It's how to work. There is a big effort now across the wildlands to get landowners themselves to really step up and be responsible within their own property to help create the defensible space. That's another phrase you hear a lot, to try to help this whole effort. So that when fires come, there's an opportunity to actually and a defensible space, by the way, is the vegetation around what you've got, around your property, your house. But the whole package is important, and that begins with actually what kind of building materials, what kind of building design goes into all of that, so that the place will survive when fires arrive. And hopefully the broader picture will continue to improve if we can someday, if we were back as it was 100 years ago, where fire was doing that job more commonly, things would be a lot easier for people living in those regimes and in those areas. The source of ignition for those fires is also part of the story. Lightning is what started most of the fires that have just recently become this incredible number, hundreds from thousands of lightning strikes. That's an unusual lightning event. Lightning does happen, but that what happened back in June of this year was an unusual part of the natural range of variation in terms of lightning, and lightning's part of it. But also the Native Americans, the pre-European population in California, the Native Californians, they used to use fire regularly as a tool, very very deliberately, to keep areas that they were interested in cleared out of both of fuel, but also there were other purposes. In the oak woodlands, in the savannas, the edges of the valley where we get grassland moving up into the oak forest. They had a strong interest in keeping those oaks reproducing and alive and producing acorns, because it was such an important food for them. And burning is burning underneath these trees that will survive again frequent low intensity fire was a big part of the regime, and the Indians were a very big part of keeping that going on a regular basis.
You mention in the book that in the period 1987 to 2003, there were four times as many major fires in California as in the 16 years before. And so there seems to be a pattern, not just the lightning strikes of this year, but Things are getting worse year by year. What do we do?
Well, what do we do? We do what we're doing, but maybe even more of some additional things. By the way, the numbers, I think you're referring to a part where there's some evidence that that is tying an increase of frequency to climate change, to global warming, and what that does to fuels in terms of drying them and making the potential for fires to move. One of the hard things about answering these kinds of questions is that having fire in the landscape, when you get to talking about it, we easily slip into the thing about how do we fight that? How do we deal with something that we view as bad? And we got to remember where we started from here, that within our landscape, fire will happen. We can't keep it out. It's just a matter of how far apart they will come and what they will be when they arrive. And so we fight them when they come now because they're a threat, and we deal with that. But it's what we do the rest of the year that's maybe where we're having the hardest time doing the right thing, it seems like. We're still trying to put the fires out, and as we just talked about, sometimes being successful at putting out most of the fires is part of the problem. And it's that fuel management issue that comes up the rest of the year, the time of year when it's possible to work with fire, when it in the swing months of the year, in the fall and in the spring, and do it on a controlled basis. That's part of the issue. I do want to not. There may be some fire ecologists listening who are want to say something. Interrupt me right now and say, well, now remember that this is complicated. Everybody should, I hope, realize if they take a look at this little introductory book, come away with the idea that fire is as complicated as our variable landscape and our variable situation across the state is complicated. Fire is a real thing of place, and I've already mentioned that fire behaves differently in chaparral, and that's a different kind of a management issue than it does in these different kinds of forests. And ponderosa pine and giant sequoia forests are different than forests like lodgepole pine or the coast range that has pines that are bishop pine and Monterey pine. Some of the forests there are not designed, or not naturally, didn't have a regime where fire returned so often. And it would be the kind of regime where fire normally would not return for many decades, maybe even up to a century or more. And then when it came, it would be because of lots of fuel where they accumulated, a stand replacement type of fire, a crown fire, similar to what happens in chaparral, but it's been through the forest. That's not unnatural there, and you can't turn it into a ponderosa pine regime of frequent fire either. If you do, it'll be a different kind of tree that'll grow there, because those trees have adapted to that. They've figured out they're going to lose the adult trees, but they will be killed, but they hold their cones. This is one of the classic examples. Closed cone pines stay up in the tree without dropping seeds on an annual basis, waiting for the eventual hot heat of these crown fires to melt resins and release the seeds. So from these standing dead trees, a shower of seeds come out, and the trees, the next generation will come from that. My whole point is just that it is complicated, it's complex, and how we deal with each of these different kinds of landscapes will vary, and yet we do need to recognize that. And I think the individual who goes, well, it's too complicated, perhaps, for me to, what am I supposed to do as an individual? I think what I hope we can do is look around where we live, try to educate ourselves and know where we are in the landscape and become part of that. And I have a phrase that I used in the book about how it would be very great if humanity could join the very long list of fire-adapted species of plants and animals that are in California and be one of them on that list by having a relationship where we're realistic and we're knowledgeable about where we live and how fire fits into that landscape.
We only have about 2 minutes left. I'd like your opinion, your forecast. The lightning strikes in the Sierra came much earlier this year. They usually, when they do come, they come in July and then usually not quite as intense. And the major fires in Southern California usually happen in September and October. So we could normally expect much more fire ahead of us in a normal year. How do you see that?
Oh, well, you're exactly right, and you've summarized it very well. That the fire season, I heard some of the fire agency folks basically saying that, you know, we used to be able to count on a fire season starting several months after the end of rains, maybe by midsummer, and then going through the fall, and then ending when the fall rains came. And now it's changed. It seems like they're having to worry about being prepared for fire somewhere in California, in the different parts, year round. And that, again, is tied to the fact that we have people spreading out into the edges of the wildlands so much, and our population has grown so much that there, a lot of fires are being started by people, not intentionally, but by accident or by arson, and which I guess that's intentional. But and then the fires then are something that has to be dealt with because they are risking. They are a threat to the people that are living out in these areas so much now. So I guess it's just that when you start to spread out and dominate the landscape in the sense that, that humanity does now in California. That's a result we're coming to now, is that that we will see fire more often, and when it comes, it will be different. You know, just recently in the spate of incredible number of fires that got started by an unusual occurrence of lightning, some of the fires on the coast in Monterey County, there were two very big ones. One that got a lot of news and press because it threatened so many homes and it caused so much evacuation and it burned homes near Big Sur. Another fire, even bigger, in the same Los Padres National Forest, but farther south, the Indians fire burned in wilderness, and it burned for weeks and weeks and weeks, and it never got out into where there were homes. That tells you something right there, that where people are mixed in with the wildlands, we have a different challenge than where we have just managed wildland that is able to do its thing. And fire working in that wilderness is, depending on the particular history of what's gone on with suppression, is probably not a bad thing at all. It's going to happen. We've got to keep that in mind. It is an inevitable thing that will happen, and our changing that fire regime stuff is where we get into the problems. And so the answer to that, your question is, that, of course, it's going to come. And we are going to have a challenging year. The fire agency people, I should say, are going to have a very challenging year because they've already been tested so much. They've spent so much money on fire suppression very early in the year, and yet we haven't really gotten into the more normal fire season that we all know will be coming in late summer and through the fall.
That was David Carl, the author of Introduction to Fire in California, one of the University of California Press's California Natural History Guides. It's a small but very lavishly illustrated book with many photographs, tables, maps, charts, and the like, and a very informative book. This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. Coming up, I'm going to talk with Lisa Marganelli, who's the author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank, which came out about a little over a year ago and was issued in paperback a couple of months ago. We'll be back in a very short time. This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be talking for the next 20, 25 minutes or so with Lisa Marganelli, who's the author of Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank, which was recently released in its paperback edition. Welcome to Booktown.
Thanks.
This is a fascinating book because each chapter covers a different aspect of the production of gasoline. You do it in reverse order. For people who are familiar with the story of stuff, it's somewhat like that. but you're going back from the gas station and distribution. You go around with a one of those big oil or gas tankers that goes from refinery to, or from distributor's place to gas station. You go to refinery, drilling rig, and the New York Mercantile Exchange, where the oil futures are traded, and then the various countries where oil is extracted and sent here and sent other places. We could probably spend half an hour on each one of these chapters. I'd like to talk about some of the major themes that insinuate their way through them from the beginning.
Okay.
It strikes me that if you had written this book 100 years ago, it would have been much shorter, because everything would have been controlled by Standard Oil. And if you'd written it, and it all would have been domestic oil, if you'd written it even
right.
during the Depression or World War II, there would have been many oil companies, but it would all have been domestic. Now, a large part of our oil is imported, and that amount is going, and this seems to have been the result of very deliberate policy choices made 60 or 70 years ago.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, most of us don't realize that we're living in a world where the choices were made by guys who worked for FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. There was a huge oil field was discovered in Texas. It's called the Black Giant. It was 40 miles long. In 1929 and 1930, it was absolutely enormous. And there was a struggle, because at that time everybody just drilled a hole in it, and the thing began to lose pressure, and the oil sort of began to seep back into the rocks, in a way. The government stepped in to get people to control the amount of oil they were extracting from the field. And at the time, FDR's planners realized, wow, we have the potential to run out of oil, and we're going to need a lot of oil in the 40s and 50s if we're going to keep expanding our economy. And so they talked very deliberately about making a deal with Saudi Arabia. And that was how we came to be in the situation we're in today.
And part of the choice was that it wasn't so much that we were going to run out of oil quickly or absolutely, but that they thought it was a better deal to get cheap foreign oil rather mm-hmm. than use up all the oil we had in this country, or to have the cost go up as it got harder and harder to
absolutely.
Drill.
Absolutely. And the pressure went on, particularly at the end of World War II. They realized that Europe was going to need a tremendous amount of oil to kind of rebuild after the war, and they wanted to assure large supplies of oil to Europe from the Middle East.
And at that time, there was, even though we could see that we were running low, there was no thought that it might be wiser to conserve or increase efficiency. The idea was just to keep the stuff flowing.
Yeah, and at that time there wasn't much of a sense of what efficiency could do. They kind of felt like, you know, you need a certain amount of oil to run an engine. But since 1975, about three-quarters of our new energy needs have actually been met by energy efficiency. So energy efficiency has become an increasing, sort of increasing sophistication of technology, has become an increasing part of our actual energy supply.
Although the thing that always depresses me is that cars are much more efficient than they were 30 years ago. Buildings are more efficient. Electrical production is more efficient. You would think that our use of oil would have gone down, but it's continued to go up.
That's true, although actually our use of oil fell by something like 25 to 30% in the early 80s with the big jump in efficiency in cars. But we have a lot more cars driving around, and we drive a lot further in those cars. And the cars are, yeah, they're more efficient, but they're also more powerful now, so they use a tremendous amount of fuel.
Is there, I might as well just come out and use some of the topics that are going to pop up at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any sort of conspiracy? Is there anybody trying to keep more oil in use, trying to sell more? Is OPEC behind all this? Are oil speculators to blame?
You know, my feeling is that there are so many moving parts in the oil economy, starting from the gas station and going all the way back to the relationships between countries within OPEC, the relationships between countries that sell oil and uh, the oil, the major oil companies. There's so many moving parts that there really isn't a place for a conspiracy. I think the conspiracy is kind of a handy fiction in the United States that allows us to feel that it's all kind of outside our hands and look for someone to blame. We really are always playing the kind of politics of blame with oil rather than saying, goodness, we need to do something about this. So I think conspiracy is part of U.S. politics more than of oil more than the reality.
Although you do mention when you in your chapter on the New York Mercantile Exchange that many, many more millions or billions of barrels of oil get traded every day than ever move.
You mean through the Mercantile Exchange?
I mean that the people, the rights to that oil, the contracts get sold again and again and again, whereas maybe 50 or 100 times more than actual oil is pumped and sent from one place to another.
Well, that's true for the specific contracts that are trading in the New York Mercantile Exchange, because there's every day there's only, in reality, there are only 200,000 barrels of that particular kind of oil, and those paper barrels are traded into infinity to establish a price. But at the same time, actually, there are more than 80 million barrels of oil actually change hands every day, and those prices are keyed to the prices that are determined by the paper barrels. So there is a reality to it. It's just that it's one of those sort of financial netherworlds that when you really look at it, you say, God, this is weird. You know, how can this be set by a bunch of guys trading in New York? But it actually works kind of as a tool for determining what people think is the fair price. And we're obviously seeing that prices got way overheated here. And you know, they fell by $12 last week, $12 a barrel, I think.
And the oil that actually travels goes in places that people who are thinking of conspiracies might not have in mind. Like most of the Middle Eastern oil actually goes to Europe and Japan. We get most of ours, or we did, from Venezuela and Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So you sometimes wonder, why are we so involved in propping up regimes or overthrowing regimes in the Middle East when we don't use much of that oil ourselves?
Right. Well, there are a lot of kind of old ideas in our foreign policy around oil, and one of them is that the U.S. needs to protect oil shipping lanes, and that by doing that, the U.S. Guarantees kind of economic stability for everyone else. You know, we're like the big uncle who steps in and makes sure that the oil flows everywhere. And at the same time, that increases our military prestige. But I think that those are ideas that we really need to question. I mean, I think that having Americans pay lots of money to police oil shipping lanes and keep the status quo in the Middle East is an awfully expensive proposition, and it might not be actually giving us very much. My feeling is it should be something more like a NATO-type group where all the oil-consuming countries gather together and police those shipping lanes and work things out.
And the cost,
including China and India.
India. And right now Iran is trying to make deals with those with China, India, Russia and other countries. We've been so unpleasant to them. I don't know if this is the only reason, but our unpleasantness to Iranian governments in the last 30 years has certainly inducing them to look elsewhere.
Well, yeah, there's certainly lots of shoppers out there who are willing to come and buy that oil. It's one of the ironies of the U.S. policy around oil is that we believe in sanctions, and the whole reason that Iran came to the table this time and the U.S. came to the table was because the U.S. is thinking of putting more sanctions on Iran. But studies have shown sanctions don't actually work. They don't get countries to conform to the U.S.'s will, and they don't punish the right people in the country. They tend to punish the poorest, most disenfranchised. 11 years of sanctions in Iraq did almost nothing of value, and they certainly did a lot of harm. But what sanctions are doing now is that they basically make it so that China and India and anybody who wants to break a sanction gets access to cheaper oil, and they don't have to compete, you know, against U.S. buyers in that oil market, and the U.S. is effectively locked out of that. So it's kind of it's one of those ironies where you'd say, well, now there must be a conspiracy at play here because this seems to be perfectly awful for the U.S.
And then that leads to China dealing with countries we dislike, like Sudan, and with countries we have ambivalent feelings toward, like Chad.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things you point out in the chapter on Chad is how unfortunate becoming an oil-producing country is for most of them, that the militarization goes way up. They spend much more money on their militaries than other countries. I think you say they spend between 2 and 10 times more on their militaries than other developing countries. And then on the next page, you say those of the study of 97 developing countries, those without oil grew 4 times as much as those with oil. What's
right.
happening?
Well, oil is just one of those sort of stunting things on an economy. I mean, oil comes out of the ground, and it hardly requires anybody to get it out of the ground. And then the oil money just... And then the oil travels immediately out of the country. And then the oil money itself comes back in, sort of almost through a pipeline itself, into the central bank, where it goes directly into the hands of whoever's in charge of the country. So suddenly, leading the country becomes a way to get your hands on money. And you don't really have to do anything in exchange for it. You don't have to have a good tax system. You don't have to have a decent road system. You don't have to even be able to provide basic security or water or electricity, anything. You don't even, in Chad, they were just, when I was there, they were just installing a generator so that they had a little electricity in the Ministry of Finance. And they were doing everything in pencil on big ledgers. So they were going to have billions of dollars coming in. And you knew that they weren't going to be able to account for that. So that money was going to come in and go out. And in addition, it allows all sorts of freelancers to spring up. Like there are a lot of militia or rebel groups in Chad. And I was talking to someone who works in human rights. He travels in and out of the country. And he said, basically, what's happened is you have this very weird economy of peace. These rebel groups run in. They attack the central government, not really for political reasons. They have some political reasons, but that's not their overriding purpose. Their purpose is to provide a little irritation, just enough so that they get a payoff from the oil money. Then they go back out to the countryside, buy some more guns, bide their time. And in the meantime, somebody else comes into the city, attacks the central government, gets paid off, goes back out to the countryside. So you have this perfectly awful cycle of escalating violence and chaos.
And I think that happened just 2 months ago in Chad.
It happened just 2 months ago. It's happened a lot in Chad. It happens in Nigeria on a whole different scale, with a lot of oil being stolen out of the pipelines and sold through these kind of black market oil networks, and then traded for guns that come back in, and that escalates the violence. The violence in the Niger Delta is on par with Chechnya. It's about 1,000 deaths a year. And it's a very small area, and it's just terrifying to live there. Almost everybody has stories of nearly being hit by gunfire, or people just have really terrifying, sad stories there.
Both Nigeria and Chad were very undeveloped when the oil was found, and the oil wealth seems to have just exacerbated that. Venezuela was actually a pretty comparatively prosperous country in 1940, and the oil led to a massive increase. I wouldn't say it's just the oil, but since oil was discovered, there's been a massive increase in population and a massive increase in poverty.
Right. It also spurred this really dramatic urbanization, because people came to the cities because that's where the money was coming out. People compare the oil money, the oil in Venezuela, to a giant cow, and they say you need to get in position so that you can catch the milk. And what happened was people rushed to the cities, and they built these sort of barrios up in the hillsides, these big crumbling structures of people just kind of waiting for money or jobs or opportunities. because it seemed like nothing was going to go to the countryside. And what happened was their whole economy sort of turned upside down. They had this agrarian economy. They grew lots of eggs. And suddenly in the 1950s, all these people moved into the cities, and increasing in the 60s, suddenly they were importing eggs from the United States because they had lots of foreign currency and they didn't have people out there growing in the countryside. So you had this kind of huge upheaval, and that really continues in Venezuela. The effects of that continue to this day.
And in Iran, it's been much more complicated because there have been overthrows of the government.
Right, and you throw First religion into the mix.
Right.
And it still is a battle between people trying to catch the milk, but in this case, there's the whole element of religion and piety is added into it. The current president of Iran was elected on the platform of putting the petroleum on people's tables. And yet, since he's been elected, there's been huge inflation, and the number of jobs really hasn't grown. Iran has a big youthful population. And so, even though all this money has come in, it really hasn't benefited the people of Iran that much.
And the two countries, once undeveloped countries that are growing the fastest, are the ones that have almost no oil themselves, India and China.
Right. China actually has a pretty big chunk of oil, but it needs an awful lot of oil. And here's one of the, whenever you start off kind of looking for a conspiracy in oil, you almost inevitably find something way more interesting. And it's become pretty common in the U.S. to talk about how China's trying to get oil, taking oil from us, or they're competing for oil, or if we don't use oil, China will use it. But one of the amazing things that's happening right now is that China is actually exporting oil to us in the form of deck chairs and plastic gigos and sneakers and all kinds of other things. About one-fifth of the energy that China consumes is actually directly exported in goods to us.
Just to
is really kind of staggering. They're, in a sense, shopping for oil for us.
And just adding to our balance of payment deficit,
yeah.
and the decline in the dollar.
Yeah.
You do mention that in the late 70s and 80s, after the two oil shocks of 73 and 79, there was a big effort for greater efficiency with things like the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit,
right,
and so on. This time around, oil prices or gas prices have gone up much faster and farther than they did, and almost nothing seems to be happening.
Yes, it's really amazing. I think what's happening is this kind of familiar song and dance about, on the one hand, politicians try to punish the oil companies. They have congressional hearings. They try to bring the executives in and, give them a little roasting. And then they talk about having windfall profit taxes and other things that they're not going to really follow through on. And at the same time, there's a lot of talk about offshore drilling, which is really the oil companies know that they're going to get punished when prices are high, and they're not terribly concerned with it. They see it as inevitable, but it is a chance for them to get through offshore drilling or drilling in parklands because people are so frustrated. At the same time that people want to, when prices are high, people want to punish the oil companies, and they want more oil, and they're much more likely to vote for drilling in protected lands, which is very profitable for the oil companies. It doesn't necessarily, it adds something to the U.S. oil supply, but it doesn't significantly add. It's just highly profitable oil because they're not paying the same rate that they would be paying in an OPEC country. So what you see is this kind of big show of punishment and opening protected lands for drilling, and you don't see people talking about the real stuff like a 55-mile-an-hour speed limit. There were, in the early 80s, California did these studies on what we could do if we retimed our traffic lights. I mean, we could really be saving, it's something like, 2 or 3% of the gas in the state by retiming the traffic lights, and it would make people happier,
And that was never done?
No, it was done in specific cities, but at this point, it would all need to be redone.
So in 1 minute, can you give us your solution to all this?
I think we really, really need to focus on energy efficiency, and we really need to focus on using a lot less gas. And so that means for us as individuals saying, okay, I'm going to combine trips, I'm going to ride my bike, I'm going to carpool, I'm going to do whatever I can, or I'm going to switch to a smaller car. I'm just going to try to cut the amount of gas that I use dramatically, not for economic reasons, for somewhat for moral reasons, because it may cost us $4.50 a gallon, and we may consider that painful. And it is true that it is painful, but the pain that is paid by the people at the other end of the pipeline is enormous, and it's far more than $4.50. So there's moral reasons as well as economic reasons. And I really think that we need to really push our politicians for real solutions. We need to solve climate change and energy security. And we need to do that through energy efficiency and then gradually introducing really thoughtful alternative fuels that don't have supply chain problems of their own. You know, it's not a great thing to have biofuels or battery-operated cars if the minerals for the batteries and the supplies for the biofuels are also coming from unstable places or places that are being destabilized.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Thome. I've been talking with Lisa Marganelli about her book, Oil on the Brain, Petroleum's Long Strange Trip to Your Tank, which recently came out in paperback. We could have gone on for much longer, but that's all we have time for. We're going on to music in a minute, so thanks for talking with me for this much time.
Thank you.
And now, stay tuned for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party.